Podcast mit Tatjana Lackner.
Today I'm not at the studio, but in Dürnstein at the Philosophico meeting Colin Crouch, who is a political scientist and the author of a very famous book about post-democracy. The first thing, I really liked your speech. I thought that it was great that you did it in German. It must have been quite an effort to do it.
Yeah, I tried to do it. German and Italian, I tried to do it.
Okay. Politics has never been about idealism, but always about finding majorities, compromises, solutions. So my question is, sometimes I have the feeling it is like, well, we need idealistic ideas. Mm. Is that really what politics is about?
Politics is a compromise between idealistic ideas and compromise outcomes. You start off with goals that you believe in, that have a moral quality, but you need to rub along with other people who are powerful, who don't share those views, and you try to reach shared outcomes. Sometimes people are very happy with that. Sometimes people feel it is a kind of disgrace. They feel that you lose your virtue by doing that.
You pointed out in your speech that we should have rules made by the government and not by economical structures. But on the other hand, we have a lot of economical aspects like Google, Facebook and Apple that ruled our world much more in the last years than parliaments did.
Well, I wouldn't say we need to be ruled by government and not by market. For many purposes, the market is a very good way of organising human life. It's a really useful mechanism. And when it gets into difficulties and leads us into bad places, like in the finance crisis, we should not throw out the baby with the dirty water. So we need the market and we need politics. The difficulty is getting a balance between those two and ensuring that both the market and politics respect each other's boundaries. And it's not good if politics starts to intervene in the economy in a way that disturbs the good outcomes. Like, for example, if you just have massive public debt, never try and repay it, that's not a good thing. The same, if the market interferes too much with politics, then we are unable to pursue goals that are not those of the market. But then there's a third thing, which I think you're talking about now, and that is the power of big enterprises is neither politics nor market, because they're not actually subject. Big monopolies, big oligopolies are not subordinate to the market. They dominate the market. And that's the most problematic of all. And you're right to say the internet sector has become a new sector for this. We have experience of it in the past with energy, with big banks. Now there is this new issue of the big internet giants who claim that they don't belong to any sector of the economy. And they claim that they don't have any geographical location. They're extraterrestrials. So, for example, Uber say, we should not be subject to the rules that govern urban transport. Because we're not a transport company, we're a platform. And they say, well, we're not located in this country, where we may have all our activities there, we get customers there, we have our taxis there. Oh, we're somewhere else. Now, that is beginning to pose real problems of governability. They are producing problems partly because they define themselves in such a way that they do not belong to any sector. So, like Uber say, they're not transport; they're a platform, so they shouldn't
Airbnb.
Be under. They shouldn't be under transport. Yeah. And now, if you take the publishing industry, books, magazines, newspapers, publishers are subject to a lot of rules about libel. And if an author writes something libelous, libel. When you write something that attacks an individual and tells lies about them. For the publishing industry, we have these rules about truth and denigration and attacks on people, hate speech. the platform companies say, we are not part of the publishing industry, so none of that applies to us, right? So we're free. So that means that something that a newspaper cannot do legally, the platform can, because it defines itself.
So there
is a problem that they are, in various ways, they're defining themselves as outside the reach of anything else. They're also defining themselves as outside the reach of taxation. So at the moment, shops in the high street cannot compete with Amazon. Because you have a shop in High Street, you pay a property tax, you pay value-added tax, you pay all sorts of taxes. Amazon don't have to pay anything. They'll be taxed in the country, usually Ireland, which has the lowest tax rate. So the firms in the High Street can't compete with them. So the internet sector is creating these sorts of problems. Whether it threatens democracy, it certainly threatens the market, actually.
But I think it's different with social media, if you take Facebook or Instagram, because we use something, we use a software to have an account there. So they offer something which we use, and we don't pay anything for that.
Gotcha.
I mean, this is different with Amazon, of course, but all the others, I mean, we use...
They're free, yes.
Of course.
The advertiser, they get money, we now know, by selling information about us, which now they're required to say they do.
But the real visions came out of little enterprises like Apple, Tesla, Google, and not out of parliaments.
That's right. Well, that's the entrepreneurial sector, yes. And I can remember, not so long years ago, when Apple... were really struggling, and it seemed that Microsoft would be completely dominant, and so they would not let Apple use their platforms. And there was a case before the European Court of Justice, because the Europeans are tougher on monopoly than the Americans are. And Microsoft's argument was, why should we spend money to enable this failing enterprise to survive?
What we did with banks.
Why are our customers having to pay more money to keep Apple alive? No one wants Apple. Now, it looks very different today.
Yeah, that's true. So do you think that digitalization in general could be a kind of solution for our democratic aspirations, for our will to be democratic? Is it a solution?
It's not a solution. It's a technique that can be used by lots of different forces. Certainly, we've seen how social media have been extremely useful to organisations wanting to have campaigns, for example. But we also know now, after the experience of the Trump election and of the Brexit vote, we know that very, very rich people and the Russian government are capable of using their resources to give the impression that there is a mass of activities going on from many, many different sources, when really it's a small number of people controlling it.
Even Barack Obama did so.
Did he? It started with him. All right, so that's right. Yes,
so it's not only a right-wing thing, it's also...
Well, when we have at the moment, this is not really politically important, I think. We have in Britain at the moment this American actress who has married one of our princes, and she's half black, and she's a radical feminist. And the conservative part of the country hate her. Mm-hmm. And she receives thousands of hate messages and death threats every day. And they've discovered that these come from a very small number of sources. There's about 20 different groups are doing this to her. But gives the impression that millions of people are doing it.
Yeah,
and this
not.
Is
yeah.
really
yeah.
dangerous.
But I'm talking about digitalization like robots, for instance.
Yeah.
We have AI in our branches, in our working places. So we have a completely different setup concerning... Well, is this a worker? Do we have to pay taxes for him or her?
Yeah.
So could this be a solution to our democratic idea?
No. I think artificial intelligence, first of all, creates problems of a kind that I discussed. But that does not mean we should try and stop it. The problems it creates is the abolition of jobs. But our history, going way back, certainly to the invention of printing, probably earlier. Our history shows us that when technology replaces some kinds of work, it liberates human beings to do something else. We can always find things to do for each other. So I don't think artificial intelligence is a threat. It will, however, cause disruption, like all technological change. Some people lose their jobs, skills they have with great difficulty acquired become irrelevant. And that's social disturbance, and we need social policy to help people through that. So I think artificial intelligence certainly is politically relevant. I don't think it necessarily helps democracy.
I give an example. I wrote six books. For the research of my last book, I noticed that, so I was researching an elderly home in Osaka in Japan, for instance, and they have, this is completely in the hand of Panasonic. They have robots on duty instead of staff. Mm. And the interesting thing was that the customer experience, or the customer satisfaction, so to speak, was 100%.
Right.
So what does it do with us? I mean, because all the others working on those places and helping elderly people, they didn't have 100%.
No. Yeah, there is a general lesson in social science research here, and that is experiments are always better than everyday reality. Because in an experiment, everything is done to get it right. It gets attention and resources that ordinary life doesn't have. Just give you a tiny example. 30 years ago, I had to have an operation on a hernia. And they had been doing some experiments with the keyhole surgery, laparoscopy, and they were getting wonderful results from this. And then someone said, wait a minute, these are experiments. They're always being done by professors. Normally, hernia operations are how doctors do their first operations. Let's have an experiment where we have some people have the keyhole surgery, some the old-fashioned surgery. It will all be done by professors. I was part of that experiment. I had the ordinary surgery, but it was done by a professor. And they found there was no difference in the two techniques. It was the fact that an experiment gets the best resources. So I want more than one old people's home in Osaka before I make a judgment.
Okay, right? Good. When we talk about market and you pointed out in your speech that there is a kind of healthy market theory.
Yeah.
What is that, for example?
Well, it depends. In large parts of the economy, the market, with certain basic rules, gives us perfectly good outcomes. There's a large number of producers. They produce some products. We choose between them. They have an incentive to improve their products and to give us more choice. We can choose. If we're not satisfied with one, we can go to another next time. That's where the market works. It also gives us a way of comparing different things. Do I want to buy a new coat, or do I want to buy some new shoes? Well, you can choose on the price.
As long as we have them.
And so that, for large parts of our daily lives, and also big decisions, that works very well. But sometimes there's about five conditions, if I can remember them all, in which this doesn't work so well. One is when we have what economists call negative externalities. Mm-hmm. This is when the market activity affects people outside the transaction who cannot be represented in the transaction. The biggest examples are environmental damage.
Okay.
So I've got a factory, I buy some materials, I employ some people, I sell some goods, you buy my goods. They are all market transactions, but I'm polluting the river. That's not a market transaction. The people who suffer from that are not my customers. I don't care about them. So the negative externalities, especially environmental damage, the market is very bad at solving, unless there's a regulation that forces the market to recognize externalities. But that needs intervention. Second is when there's imperfect competition. So when there's two or three producers, perhaps, in a sector. That's not a good functioning market. Thirdly, when there is inadequate information, because the...
bottom up or top down?
Both directions.
Okay.
The market theory assumes that we know all relevant information about
the product.
And the financial crisis was the biggest single example of where traders were trading so quickly they did not know what they were buying and selling. They had no idea until someone one day calls foul, and then they discovered, we have all these bad debts. They didn't know. Fourth It's a false. The final one is when there's inequality that can't be economically justified, which leads to distortions of consumption. And then, what's another one? Well, perhaps these are enough.
Those are enough already.
That when you have these characters... public goods.
What?
Public goods are things that cannot be owned.
Air,
certainly. Water you can, but water, fresh air. So public goods, or they might be abstract qualities like truth, trust. These are things that can't be owned, so the market can't produce them. Mm-hmm. And it might damage them, actually. It can damage them, and they become externalities. So there are these circumstances, and I think we can define them fairly tightly. Either we have to try and introduce market into these things, or we say, now here the market can't work, and it means possibly direct state action, or it means regulation, or it means using various non-market actors.
But if you look through the history of markets in general, we had quite a lot of crisis already, like 30s and
absolutely.
Bubbles. But is this already a key factor that you say market theory is instable? I mean, it was stable for so many decades. And of course, we have a lot of interruptions, like this was a crisis and that is a crisis. But in the end, what would be the alternative?
Well, we know what the alternative is, and we have it, actually. The debate becomes one of more or less. We have the direct state action, regulation, making space for third actors, sort of non-state, non-market.
Out of the crisis we had here in Austria, we installed a kind of FMR, Finanzmarktaufsicht.
That would be a regulatory thing, yeah.
Would you say, we need, out of the crisis, we need more kind of institutions or regulations like that?
Yeah, and sometimes you decide these no longer serve a purpose and you must abolish them, so you don't necessarily get more and more and more. But yes, you need these things, which we often have. But the under the influence of neoliberal thinking, there are too many governments and international organizations decided they didn't need so much of this anymore.
Is there a country where you think, this would be perfect? I mean, if we roll out this through the world, this is a kind of role model where things, this is a market, here's the frame, the politics, and here are the institutions that are kind of control instances, whatever.
I can probably think of lots of examples where regulation works quite well. I mean, you in different places, different times. I would say European food regulation works quite well. It's true, it's protectionist against the rest of the world. That's the price you pay.
But is there a country where you say market and
are in perfect balance?
Well,
it changes from place to place all the time. I mean, for a long while, Sweden was the example that one would cite. It's the Swedish model's become unbalanced in recent years. But the Scandinavian countries in general have probably got the best records, actually. Mm-hmm. And from time to time, Austria, actually. Austria
really?
And the Netherlands, yeah. From time to time, yeah.
So we had this Brexit thing, and in your speech you pointed out that this was, if you look at it from a different point of view, it was kind of a very democratic group who said, we are not prepared to stay in the Union, we want to get out. Was it really a good model for democracy? I mean, there was this Boris Johnson who told everybody, like, this was a very populistic guy. Mm. So was this really a kind of group of people?
The problem we have in Britain is that the first problem is, which we didn't know was a problem, but I think it's now a problem. We have never had a written constitution. We have constitutional law, but our constitutional law can be changed in Parliament by a majority of one vote. We have no special procedures. So you can change the voting system just with a majority of you go. Which means that's all right if you have a system with very high trust and where no one pushes at the boundaries. But over the last few decades, this has been wearing out. Now, one of the things we have no constitutional rules for are referenda. Referenda came into our practice in the 1950s, in order to solve a problem whether some towns in Wales could have their pubs open on Sundays or not. Because
Tom Jones told them one day,
It was a religious, different kinds of Protestant. Yeah. And the government of the day did not want to get involved in this. I'll let them have a referendum in each town by town. That put the idea of a referendum for the first time. So later, we've done it once, we can have it again. So we've used referenda usually to solve problems within parties, actually. Mm-hmm. So, but we have no rules. We make the rules up as we go along. And the relationship between referenda and parliament are not clear. Whether you should have a second referendum, there's no rules about. It was discovered recently, and has been judged by our Supreme Court, that the Russian government and various American millionaires illegally funded the Brexit campaign.
Yeah.
Now, so people are... And the campaign was fined some money.
And Boris Johnson was what? A kind of puppet in between, or what was he?
Puppet in between.
Yeah.
And then so people said to the government, well, what happens now about the Brexit result? I said, well, nothing. Mm-hmm. We don't have a rule for that. In a parliamentary election, if a candidate spends illegal money, they lose their seat. Right? Yeah. But it has no implications. So referenda don't have an accepted place with us. So that means this wasn't a good precedent. And you might, if you want to do it, you do it properly, like they do in Switzerland or in California, or actually in Italy, where you have a referendum rule, right? Yeah. And it's clear, and the referendum rule has to be made outside the framework of an individual referendum.
But what is wrong being a kind of Singapore or Hong Kong in the European Union? I mean, there are a lot of people who say when this is made in England again, and when we earn our, it's kind of pride thing. We're happy to be on ourselves.
Yeah.
And quite a few say, well, I'm not so sure about it.
Well, I've got two sets of objections to Brexit. One is practical, the other is idealistic. The practical one is, if you were going to do this, then first you know exactly what you want. We triggered that famous Article 50 with still complete conflict within the government itself, and not just within the Conservative Party. So they went into it not knowing what they wanted. Now, this is just stupid, right? So that's a practical problem. The idealistic one is, there are so many problems in the modern world where we need each other. Climate change, taxation of the new internet sector and similar non-terrestrial sectors, and regulation of global finance. There's at least three things where no country can act alone. There is no sovereignty. Punkt. Right? It doesn't exist. What you do is you share sovereignty. And the European Union is the best example in the world of that. And so for me to come out from that is just a step backwards.
Okay. You pointed out that we have a lot of problems from the left-wing parties, from the right-wing parties. And you were talking about South America, for instance. Mm. So South America has a lot of problems with their populism.
Yeah.
Who were financed with the money of the left-wing party people like Holland, for instance, the Netherlands, and they gave money to dictators like Hugo Chavez, like Evo Morales, to bring them up. So we in Europe have the feeling the right populists are bad guys. I take your bad guys again. But in the end, very often the left-wing money was bringing up a lot of catastrophes, for instance, in South America.
Yes, in Europe we mainly have right-wing populism, except in Greece, and there's the left-wing populism, and there's a Podemos movement in Spain, which is weak at the moment. But so there is a sort of left-wing populism, but mainly we have the right-wing in the Latin America, as you say, it's the other way around. The problem, as I was trying to say this morning, the problem with populists is that in order to enter the system, they have to make a lot of noise and break the rules. The thing is, do they then start to accept institutions? Now, what's been clearly happening in Latin America is they've not accepted institutions. And this means problems with the rule of law, the Rechtsstaat. And it also, it's not unique to them, but there's also massive temptations for corruption. And that's what's destroyed Venezuela.
Yeah, Venezuela, for instance, if you take Maduro, there are a lot of European politicians who say, well, now the new one, we accept you, although we don't have a kind of regulation, we don't have, this was not an election.
Yeah.
So we.
Oh, yeah, that, yes, that's strange, isn't it, actually, the acceptance of Maduro, yes. I'm uneasy about
that. I mean, it's
that.
A putsch, simply. It is
a putsch, yeah. You're right, yes, it is. And if you look back at the old system in France and Italy, or they had these champion national, these national champion firms like Fiat in Italy. They actually did a lot of economic good to getting their countries forward, but they developed really very corrupt relations with the political class. They funded. There's certain laws you will never get in Italy because they might interfere with Fiat's interests. I mean, it's changed now, but so they're in politics, when firms and politics get too close together, there's a danger they both damage democracy because it's only these are privileged actors, and it also damages markets at the same time.
So it's a monopoly. Okay. Thank you so much for the interview. Thank you.
Das war's für heute. Besuchen Sie mich doch in der Schule des Sprechens in Wien. Auf Facebook, LinkedIn, Xing, unter sprechen.com oder auf meinem Blog sprechen.com/blog.